Welcome into a fresh episode of Fireside Sports, presented by Oregon Sports News. I'm your host, Casey Mabbitt. With me is my good friend and co-host, Bryant Knox. Many of you know Bryant. Those that don't, shame on you. Make sure you follow him at Bryant Knox on Twitter. You can find him on Oregon Sports News. He's a contributing columnist. He's also an editor. He's a man of many talents, but he's also a sports aficionado, and that's why we like to have him here. He knows sports more than any of us do, so we like to have him speak, and then we can be quiet and sound smart by not talking. So, Bryant, thank you very much for coming on. Great to have you on. Happy New Year to you and your family and everyone you hold dear. Hope you're having a great 2018. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well, Casey. It's good to be back on. You and I were talking before we got started that the holidays were very good, very successful, but very long and very tiring. So I think I'm going to be as cliche as everyone on the planet and say, new year, new me. I'm starting fresh. I'm ready to go.
Love it. Well, and it's a pre-show meeting because we're official here. We have all the same amount of money and, you know, stuff to do as ESPN. So why can't we have meetings? So
I think you're right.
Yeah, you know, this is not a well-funded show, so if you're out there and you're thinking, how can I spend my new money in 2018, Bryant and I will not be shy about saying, we will take your money. We will, you know, Gene the intern can't even afford a mic. We just point at him and laugh. So, you know, if you're a sponsor out there, we'll gladly take your money. We are not against that. We love charity. We really love it. So without further ado, let's dive into the topics at hand. So with a new year comes NFL playoffs. But before we get into that, let's talk about some teams that didn't make the playoffs. And there's one that is a very dear team to many in the Northwest, and that's the Seattle Seahawks. And this is the first time in the Russell Wilson era that they have not made the playoffs, and only the second time in the Pete Carroll era. So, Brian, I assume you saw that they didn't make it. Is there something they could have done differently this year other than outscore their opponents more frequently that you think they could have done to make this a season to remember instead of a season to forget?
Well, they could have not had an injury at every single turn. I think that would have helped.
It would have helped.
Obviously, things that are under their own control. You and I talked about a couple times this season how the offensive line it was never going to get better from the start of the year, so I don't think you can necessarily blame them, but I think that they could have come into the year with a better plan, a better approach, heck, a better roster. I know it's a crazy idea, but they, too often we seem to sort of giving credit to Russell Wilson for extending plays and for taking a broken down play and turning it into 3.5 yards when it should have been -6. We shouldn't stop giving him credit for that, but we should start looking at the bigger picture, which is that the Seahawks need to find a way to make it so he doesn't have to do that multiple times a game. I mean, the Seahawks come out there and they rely on Russell Wilson to turn a broken play into something more, and you're just asking for trouble if that's the way that you're going to approach it.
Well, and you mentioned their offensive line. They tried to get better there after George Fant went down in the preseason, their left tackle. They traded for Dwayne Brown of Houston. That kind of worked, not really. It was a little too late in the season for him to really get acclimated, so look at that being better for next year. But they're down Cam Chancellor, down Richard Sherman. They were kind of down Bobby Wagner for a spell, down KJ Wright for a little bit. They could not seem to stay healthy. They had Earl Thomas miss a couple games. They lost, I don't know how many running backs to injury. They just couldn't replace any of them with a talented runner. Chris Carson, I think, is the rookie's name that got hurt against Indy and was gone for the season after he looked so sharp. It just goes on and on. So to your point, injuries were a huge deal here. And also the depth behind other starters, you know, they need some better starters to begin with, and they need some depth to go behind it. You know, one of the things that made them so special in 2013, 2014 is how deep they were on every side of the ball. Now you've got this year where you're really seeing that they are stretched so thin and what the talent looks like behind the starters when those starters get banged up or lost for the season. Would you trade a guy like Richard Sherman or Jimmy Graham if you could get a first round pick for him and just start fresh, or do you feel like those are guys that you can't really move?
I would definitely trade a Jimmy Graham because I think he is as good as he is. I think you can find someone a tier lower and still feel as if you've replaced him adequately.
Sure.
So if you can find someone, say, at a position where you are lacking that depth that you spoke about, and maybe downgrade Graham one tier, but upgrade one tier as well at another position, I think that's well worth it. Sherman, I'm hesitant to say you can replace him just because of the culture factor. I know that there have been plenty of, you know, locker room leaks and media rumors that he has either spoken out of turn or people have spoken about him in a less than flattering way. But I think that is to essentially say we are starting over in terms of the culture and in terms of the talent at that position. And I think you have to, you know, first of all, figure out how he's going to recover from the injury, because that's going to determine if he even has much trade value. Because you definitely don't want to ditch him for pennies on the dollar. But I think that if you figure out that, yes, he's going to come back healthy, but no, he's not going to have a huge impact, you then have to decide what is more important, keeping the current culture and the current vibe, if you will, or starting fresh.
Yeah, I think that he's a guy that you'd have some people kind of polarized by him, that they really like him as a player, but they don't like his personality, and they'd be okay with his age and the Achilles injury potentially derailing him, that they'd be okay with getting what you can for him now and not risking it. But I just don't see them trading Sherman. I think that it would be smart to play the field with him, but at the same time, I don't know that the Seattle faithful would like that move. Jimmy Graham, I feel like every Seattle fan I've talked to has been fine with them trading him, and they were actually surprised that they didn't make a move around the trade deadline this year. And now that his talent and star appeal have started to dwindle in the last couple of years, I don't know that there's a lot of teams out there that would want to take him. And that's the problem, is that those are probably your two best assets right now. Russell Wilson being one that I would say is untouchable, but he'd definitely be the top asset at this point. But you really can't trade him. I don't know that you can get what you deserve for Sherman, so I'm not sure making a trade makes sense. And then Graham is probably not going to get you much more than like a third or fourth round pick at this point. So, and you had a successful enough season that you're going to have a low pick in the first round. So now what? You know, do you just dump everybody and start fresh, or do you just pick up pieces as you go? I mean, they seem like they're turning into the Green Bay Packers, which as a Packer fan, I can tell you that's a scary sight. Where your defense is dwindling, your offense can't quite get it done, you're injured every year, you're just good enough that you can compete, but not bad enough to get a good draft pick, so you just have these, you know, we'll say quote-unquote mediocre 10-6 seasons where you don't really get anything done, but you're a playoff bubble team. It's kind of like the Blazers, which we'll get into at a later time, but I just, you know, at what point do you decide we're going to just implode the whole thing and start fresh?
Well, if the rumors that Pete Carroll was looking at retirement had been true, I'd say do it now.
Right.
Because at that point, you don't have to worry about maintaining the culture beyond the fans. And that's an easy thing for me to say as someone who is not a diehard Seahawks fan. But from the outside looking in, if Pete Carroll has decided to hang it up, you now have, at the very least, you have a reason to blow it up and rebuild.
Right.
But as soon as he squashed those, in my opinion, you take the rebuild off the table and you just focus on retooling. You focus on which positions, like I said with Jimmy Graham, which positions can you downgrade in order to upgrade somewhere else so that you're not just balancing out, you're actually giving yourself a competitive advantage.
Yeah, and I think that's what they'll have to do, and they've also got to look at Cam Chancellor, who had to end the season with a gruesome neck injury. Can he still play? If he can't, there's not really a way to really replace him overnight. You've already got backups starting at running back. You know, Chris Carson will be back next year, but we'll see if he's as good as advertised or if it was just a couple games that we saw and had a little more optimism than we'd really deserved. You've got Richard Sherman, who may or may not come back at full strength. You have some guys behind him that are okay but not great. It's gotten to the point now where you used to have so much strength across the roster that you only had a couple positions you could really worry about. Now it's kind of the opposite, where you've got Russell Wilson, you've got Michael Bennett, you've got Dwayne Brown, you have Earl Thomas. After that, you really don't have and Doug Baldwin also. I feel sorry for saying and Doug Baldwin, because he's always underrated and forgotten. He's the afterthought, but he's such a great player, such a great guy. But after that, you really don't have anybody that teams, I think, would want to trade a first-round pick or a key player for. So I think you're right that you're going to have to retool and find creative ways to do it. But I don't know that this will be easy for the next couple of years. They've relied so heavily on their defense and running game, and now those are the two components that aren't quite there. Can Russell Wilson really do this on his own? I don't think so, but I think we're about to find out one way or the other in the next year or two, because there may not be anything else to work with.
Yeah, and I think that they're going to have, you know, ideally, a healthier season next year. So they're going to have a better idea of what they have after next season, which is another reason that I say you retool, you don't rebuild quite yet, because you give your squad a chance as is. And if under a healthy, complete season, they still kind of, you know, lay an egg, then that's when you can really truly consider the rebuild.
Right. Well, we'll see what they have in store for them. Their 2017 season's officially in the past, and they're on to the offseason. So moving on to the rest of the NFL, I want you to think, while I talk for a minute, what your two biggest surprises were this year in terms of teams. One, a biggest surprise in a good way, and one, a disappointment. Mine would be, as far as biggest surprise, I'm going to pick the Los Angeles Rams. They came out of absolute nowhere. Left field, if you can believe that, which is a baseball term. So we're going to use that here, because that's how far out of the realm of possibility it was for them to have a 12-4 record, which nobody saw coming, or maybe they're 11-5, whatever it is. Either way, it's well above and beyond what they were supposed to do. Jared Goff was supposed to be a joke and said he's an MVP candidate. Todd Gurley was supposed to be washed up and was in his third year, also an MVP candidate. That defense is playing lights out. The offense is, if not number one, then top two in the league. They're a force to be reckoned with. It's a little disappointing they only got the number three seed, so now they got to travel on the road, and they had some struggles on the road, especially in Minnesota, and I don't know if they're going to be any better in Philadelphia, but that team is crazy good versus where they were last year. They won the NFC West and got the number three seed, as I stated, and their players are just playing at an all-time high right now. It's not as good as the 99 Rams, who were the runaway number one team throughout the year and then into the postseason, but it's pretty darn good. It's special. And then my biggest disappointment is going to be the Green Bay Packers, because even before Aaron Rodgers went down, they had some struggles in the offense and the defense. After he went down, they just looked putrid. I mean, they looked like a little bit better than the Cleveland Browns. I don't know if that's saying anything. And now that they know that Brent Hundley is not a guy they can work with in the future, they got to really think that through, because Rodgers has maybe only 2 or 3 years left. And that's scary, because the drop-off between him and his backups is terrifying. So we'll see how that goes. You know, they finished the season below 500, and I think they have the number 14 or 15 pick in the draft, so they still get a good talent out of the deal and hopefully work that into better picks for next year and better players. But Brian, what were your thoughts on the season? Were there two teams that really stood out to you as being really surprising or really disappointing?
As far as disappointments go, I can't look past the Giants. It goes well beyond just their play on the field. The fact that they were as just atrocious as they were was bad enough. But then they made the unpopular decision to bench Eli Manning. And nobody quite understood it, because it's not as if they had a, you know, surefire young quarterback lined up behind him to start prepping for next year. But then as soon as fans and media started to – well, not so much media, but as soon as fans and probably Eli started to accept the fact that, okay, I'm no longer a starter, I've probably started my final game for the Giants, they bring him back into the starting lineup.
Right.
And I think that there were just so much beyond what happened on the field that it just became too much to feel bad for them anymore. Like, you have to feel bad for a guy like Eli. He's been a consummate professional, and he is a two-time Super Bowl champion. And as soon as you start to realize the surprising reality that he's probably never going to play another game for the Giants, all of a sudden they're throwing him back into the starting lineup. So for me, that was the biggest disappointment, that they just had so many troubles on the field that were just honestly not even important compared to what happened in the locker room at that point.
Yeah, it was a dumpster fire. And then, so, I mean, they fire the head coach, they fire the general manager, and then they come back and say, Eli, we're sorry, you know, we'll let you have your job back. They win, I think, two of their last four, which is impressive, given that they had only won two games the rest of the year. But it's still just kind of sad that he's ending his career on that note. And then you see his older brother, you know, going out with two Super Bowl appearances and one Super Bowl win in his last couple years. I hope Eli can get back, but I don't think it's going to be as a member of the Giants. I think even if they want him back, he's probably moved on to somewhere else. I mean, it'd be really neat if Denver could recruit him to come and play another year or two. And
Jacksonville.
that would work. And, you know, Tom Coughlin's the president of football operations there, and we know he likes Eli, and they definitely need a better quarterback. But I guess it'll really depend on how well they do this year, because they're still in the postseason hunt, and the Giants are not, so maybe they like who they have.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I would love to see Eli in Jacksonville for many different reasons. Obviously, if they're able to have a deep postseason run, you can't really justify that move. But the truth is, they rely so much on their run game and their defense, their defense in particular, that you can, if they do flop in the playoffs, you can definitely afford to or not afford from a financial standpoint, but afford from a public perception standpoint to bring in someone like an Eli to help get them to that next level, assuming Eli is still that type of player, which I think he can be with the right people around him.
What is your response or reaction if you're watching the postseason this year and Blake Bortles goes on a Eli Manning 2007 Giants-esque run and has, you know, 11 touchdowns and one interception in the postseason, and he wins the Super Bowl? Does that change your opinion of Blake Bortles, or does it? Do you just take that as a fluke?
Nope, still trash.
You'll still sit in the trash can.
Maybe that's extreme. Maybe that's extreme. Of course, it does change a little bit, because the very first time he's playing truly meaningful games, he steps up. I think there is a lot to take from that. But I will need to see it beyond just a, you know, four-game stretch, because I do think that he is finding any sort of consistency because of the people around him. And again, right, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I just think I can't put all my eggs in his basket on one individual run.
Sure. Well, let's flip over to what was your biggest surprise team in a good way. If the Giants were the biggest disappointment, who were you really impressed by?
This will probably come across as a little bit of a surprise, because they were not a great team this year, but I really liked what I saw from the Titans in the second half of the year.
Homer! You know, sorry. It's cold and flu season. I have a cough. I apologize. Please continue.
Stealing my gimmicks already, huh?
I let you have that precious 10 seconds of your own time. I couldn't help it.
Mariota dealt with some injury issues and a lot of inconsistency with the rest of the roster. But, I mean, that team going into the final game of the season was, I think, yeah, 6-1 in its seven games leading into the final against Oakland. And I think that after the way they started, which was 1-4, 1-5 maybe, nobody would have seen that coming. So, you know, obviously I'm not, like, impressed or shocked by how their entire season's worth of their resume turned out. But I do think that they put together a nice stretch during the second half, which was a pleasant surprise to me.
Sure. And, you know, I think a lot of people counted them out, especially after that terrible showing in Pittsburgh on Thursday night a few weeks ago, and they just got blasted. Well, they've turned it around since then. Mariota's looked better. The running game's looked better. The defense looked better. Everything's looked better. And we'll see what they do in the postseason. And speaking of that, that's a really great segue into our next topic, which is Wild Card Weekend, which is this weekend for those of you living under rocks. Hope those rocks have been comfortable, but you're living in the real world now. So we have, as the first matchup, we have the number 5 Titans taking on the number 4 Chiefs in Kansas City. The Chiefs are favored by 7. How much do you like the Titans in that game if they're the team that you were most impressed with?
Well, not a lot, to be honest.
It flips it so quickly, folks.
Yeah, I think that Alex Smith gets, you know, he doesn't get the recognition that he deserves.
Sure.
I think that he gets that game manager label, which is just the biggest backhanded compliment there is. And I'm not sure it's deserved, or I think if it is deserved, it's deserved in a more positive way than people intend. And, you know, I can't remember exactly what the stat was. I read the other day that all of his touchdowns came, you know, in November and beyond, which I think obviously means he doesn't have nearly as momentum or have as much momentum. But at the same time, the Chiefs have won their last 5 games coming into the wild cards. So I have really no reason to doubt that that momentum is going to slow down.
Well, and how crazy is it to think that in week 1, they ran the Patriots out of their own stadium as the defending champions, and now here they are taking on the Titans with, you know, they're 2 wins away from the AFC championship. How crazy would it be to come full circle and have them play New England in New England for the AFC title?
It'd be pretty wild. And I just pulled up their schedule. I actually got it backwards. They started their season with 5 wins.
Yeah.
But they did finish their season with 3 straight wins. So I'm sticking with my momentum claim.
And I think that's a good pick. I'm going to bandwagon there with you and take the Chiefs in that one. I think that the 7 is maybe a little generous to the Titans. I think as impressive as the Titans have been this year, they're not a playoff caliber team in most divisions. And I don't think that they would have won in some other ones, like the NFC South, for example. But I would easily take the Chiefs in that one with the points. So moving over to the next game in the AFC docket, you have the number 6 Bills facing the number 3 Jaguars. Jaguars are favored by 6.5. I think it's an easy pick to take the Jaguars. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'll take the Jags and I'll take the 6.5.
I'm not happy about it. I want to make that clear. I don't want to take Jacksonville. They forced this on me. I don't want it, but I will pick Blake Bortles the favorite for the first time ever.
I feel you there. I feel the exact same way, but like I said earlier, Bortles just has so much going on around him that I think that the 6.5 is honestly going to be, I think saying that the spread is less than a touchdown is pretty silly. I think Jacksonville probably gets it by 10 points.
I think the Bills are going to be a little tricked into mistakes in this one, even if they get LeSean McCoy back, which is no guarantee with the ankle injury he's got. Even if they have full strength, I just don't like the Bills to have a chance in this one. I think that, you know, 14 points might be even generous for a spread in this one.
Yeah, 10 to 14 seems about right for me.
Yeah. All right, so we're in agreement on the AFC games. We'll move over to the NFC, where we have game number 1 is the number 6 Falcons traveling to the number 3 Rams. And the Rams are surprisingly, I mean, this is only Wednesday, it could change by the weekend, but right now they're favored only by 5.5 points, the Rams are. I'm going to pick the Rams, but I think they can handle the Falcons by more than that. I think they'll win by at least 2 scores. What do you think?
Oh, I agree. I think that, I don't know if there's just a recency bias when the odds makers were looking at this because of who the Falcons have been and who the Rams have been. But I think that, what'd you say it was? 5.5?
5.5.
5.5. Yeah, that seems too low. I think that these teams, who they are currently in the moment, speaks to probably a 10 to 13 point spread when it's all said and done.
Well, I think you look at the Rams and they're like a bigger, stronger, faster version of last year's Falcons, and they get to play at home. So I don't know why the Falcons would be to me, that's almost like calling it a toss-up when you say it's only one touchdown or less, because I think the Rams have been so consistent on both sides of the ball. They have all the playmakers you could want. They're healthy across the board. They're at home. The first playoff game in L.A. since, like, 1993. This is going to be a rabid atmosphere, and I can't wait to see the Falcons torn to shreds, because I was actually hoping they would have a bad season after they destroyed Green Bay in the NFC Championship, so I would love to see them get just embarrassed on the road in their opening playoff game and get sent home packing.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly how odds makers work when it comes to home field advantage, but I know that there's sort of a rule of thumb, I guess. This is going to be super layman's terms because someone who actually is an odds maker would know this way better than I would, but there's sort of a rule of thumb that if you see a 3-point spread in favor of a home team, the odds maker is actually saying that it's an even pick 'em, in terms of talent on the field, right, and that they just went with the 3 because of the home field advantage. So if you're saying that the Rams are 5.5, really you're looking at more like a 2.5-point talent favorite. And again, I just don't see that.
I don't either. I think that they should be 2 scores at least, like we talked about, but maybe they're just trying to make people be more comfortable taking the underdog. That's my only thing I would look at it and see. But all right, so we're 3-for-3 so far. So the last game is going to be the Panthers, who are the 5 seed, traveling to New Orleans to take on the Saints, who are the 4 seed. And the Saints are favored by 4 points. I'm actually going to take the Panthers in this one. I know they lost twice to New Orleans earlier this year, but I think the Panthers are built to beat the Saints. I don't think the Saints have the offensive firepower they did in years past. Breeze can't sling it around the way he used to. He can't force the ball. And the defense, as good as it was earlier in the year, I'm not sold on it late in the year. And so that really just leaves a running game, which I think Carolina can stop. So I'm actually going to pick the Panthers as my lone upset. What are your thoughts on that?
I am going to go with the Saints. I think that, you know, you mentioned that they have the running game to or that Carolina can, you know, get in the box and stop. But I think that they have a very nice two-headed monster there. I think that will open up the game enough for Breeze to do some damage. And if I'm being completely honest, I just can't trust Cam Newton. I completely understand that he could come out and be the best player on the field literally any given night, but especially in a one-game playoff series. I can't fully buy into him. And I really, really do like the two-man running game that New Orleans has to offer to open up things for Breeze.
Yeah, I think it'll be a tight contest. I think that the one spread I've seen on this list that is accurate to me is this one. I think it'll be close, maybe a touchdown or less, and they've got him at 4. So I think that, you know, as long as it's a close game, I'll be happy with the result. I would like to see Carolina win, just I'd love to see one upset in Wild Card Weekend, because I think the other 3 games are pretty easy to pick. But I'll be happy if the Saints win, too, because I'd love to see Breeze have another shot at a title. It'd be really neat to see him play the Rams in the divisional round.
Yeah, it definitely would. And don't get me wrong, I do enjoy watching Cam Newton. When he is in Superman mode, he's one of the most entertaining guys to watch on a football field. But the problem is, any given night he can be great, but any given night he can sling 3 picks and drop a scrum up the middle.
Right.
So you just don't quite know which one you're going to get from him. That's how mercurial he's become, and I just can't buy into the fact that he's going to for sure put together a solid contest, which I think Carolina would need to get the win.
And our fearless intern Gene just reminded me that the Saints would not play the Rams in the next round. They would probably most likely play the Eagles or the Vikings, depending on who's still standing. Thank you for the correction, Gene. So I guess they'd play the Rams if they both make it to the NFC Championship. So that's even better, Gene. Thank you. I appreciate that. So we'll pass the torch over to Bryant to play the main role for a few minutes. We'd like to check in with the Blazers and see how they're doing, if they've got a pulse, if they're breathing okay. You know, what does their season look like? Are we happy with what we see? Do we need to see more? What are your thoughts on the Blazers, Bryant? I mean, we know you're the NBA expert here in this huge studio we've got, so we want to bring you in and see what you think about that.
Yeah, they're confusing. if I could sum it up in one word.
That's a good summary.
You know, fellow OSN columnist Jared Wright, he and I were bantering about this team early in the season. And one thing that he pointed out to me is that the Blazers are taking down inferior opponents. And that may not stand out, you know, to the casual fan as being a great thing, because you say, oh, well, you're supposed to beat these guys, so you got to beat them. But the moment you become magnanimous toward your rivals or your opponents is when you let up and you no longer have that elite mentality, that championship medal. Well, that's no longer the case for Portland, as they actually are playing up and down to their competition. And that's not what teams like the Warriors, what teams like the Cavaliers, well, maybe the Cavaliers at times, because they go into flip the switch mode. But it's not what teams with consistent championship medal do. And that's kind of what Portland's doing right now.
Well, and the big thing that I'm curious about is what would Carmelo have brought to this team to make them so different?
Carmelo's such an interesting case study right now, because if you had asked me that question, which I think you actually did, a few weeks into the season or a month into the season, I would have had a long, elaborate answer on how, yes, you're going to miss out on some of the defensive intensity that you have, but he's going to be a consistent third scoring option. He's going to open up the floor even more for Jusuf Nurkić to create down low. He's going to be able to take point guard responsibilities away from Damian and CJ at times. And now, though, I'm just not convinced that that would have even been the case, because the way that he's playing in OKC with two incredible ball handlers and scorers in Paul George and Russell Westbrook, two guys that I would imagine could motivate somebody to play off the ball, He's not playing off the ball. He's taking possessions off. He's being completely stagnant on offense. He's certainly not playing defense.
So, of course, being Carmelo.
As I'm saying this, I'm looking at him on the screen right now. He has 12 points on 5 of 8 shooting in the first half against the Lakers. So, you know, I clearly don't know anything. But what I do know is that over the course of the season, he has his reputation for being unless the ball is in his hands has really maintained itself. And again, I'd like to think that Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum would be able to get him to play that off-ball role and still be effective without the ball in his hands. But I just actually can't buy into it at this point, seeing the guys he is playing with and the way he's playing.
I feel like guys like LeBron or Jordan or Kobe make guys around them better. And then you have a guy like Carmelo, who I feel like he relies on guys around him to make him better. And if he doesn't have an all-star cast around him, I don't think he's as great as everyone thinks he is.
Yeah, that's 100% spot on. Because even when he did have guys like Amari Stoudemire and a younger Tyson Chandler on his team, he was still the primary playmaker, and he was not able to make those guys better in those situations. Those New York teams really, really underachieved, as have all of Carmelo's teams up to this point, including this current OKC squad. So, I mean, what would he have brought to Portland? He would have brought hoodies, and right. He would have brought a lot of, celebrity power to the team. But seeing what I've seen thus far, I actually think Portland dodged the bullet not getting him. Not to say that some of the pieces they would have had to trade for him are doing exceptionally well, because Mo Harkless, who was probably going to be a major piece, has underachieved this year. Noah Vonleh may have gotten in there too. He's actually played well when he's on the court, but he's not been able to see the court all that often. I just, despite the fact that Portland's pieces themselves right now aren't impressing all that thoroughly, I just don't think Carmelo was ever going to be that piece that gets Portland over the hump, knowing what we know now.
Right. Well, and something that is concerning is that right now they're a game over 500, if I can read correctly, and I like to think I can. And coming out of the preseason and the offseason, they were supposed to be, you know, a top 5, top 10 team in the NBA. Now you're looking at it and saying, is this even a playoff team? They are 1-1 this week. They've got 2 games left to go this weekend. They've got Atlanta and San Antonio. the All-Star break is around on the corner, you know, a little over a month away. Is this a team that you can see making a playoff run and actually competing with a top five team in the playoffs, or is that just a running joke that we're going to continue to laugh about for years to come?
Well, it depends on the team. I think if you put them up against the Warriors, you get exactly what you got last year. Maybe they win a game with a healthy Yusuf Nurkic, but I think you end up with a sweep to five-game series. I think against Houston, they struggle just the same. I don't think it's any different than a Golden State series. I think San Antonio is quiet enough that they can maybe steal two games against them, but you really can't bet on them to win a series against Greg Popovich. Like, just all he does is win, no matter what. But what makes me nervous isn't even so much those teams ahead of them. It's the teams directly around them and behind them. Because, I mean, Portland is struggling to win at home this season, which is a strange anomaly compared to what we're used to. But it's also a troubling trend for a fringe to mid-level playoff team. And then there's a team like the Clippers, which were supposed to be completely out of it and in a rebuild, yet they're in ninth place right now, having won, I believe, six of their last seven. And all of a sudden, you're looking at teams like New Orleans, that also is not consistent, but has been regularly in the playoff picture. So Portland just has to get the little things right, and they'll be in the playoffs. Then you just have to wonder how deep can they get. But as of right now, you also do have to wonder, are they going to continue to do those little things, or are they going to eventually do those little things like win at home and get back to completely pummeling inferior opponents?
Do you see enough from Caleb Swanigan and Zach Collins to think that they can be important pieces in the future, or are you kind of wondering if those were head-scratching moves when you see a guy like Jordan Bell doing really good things with the Warriors and they passed on him in the second round?
I think they're head scratching only in the sense that Portland traded up to take a guy at a position they were going to take the same position of in Caleb Swanigan, if that makes sense. Knowing they were taking Caleb Swanigan, I probably would have liked to see them draft someone like a Donovan Mitchell or a Malik Monk, who can be microwave scorers off the bench. I don't mean to knock Zach Collins, because I think that if Portland is able to clear the logjam up front, you know, potentially trade Myers Leonard if anybody wants him at this point, let Ed Davis go at the end of this summer, because you're probably not going to be able to afford his next contract, considering I believe you're already the fourth highest payroll in the NBA, maybe fifth at this point. It makes sense that you take Collins as a future piece. Swanigan, I like him as a perpetual role player, borderline starter, or someone who can at least step in as a starter. I just think that as good as he was in his summer league and as good as he's been in terms of how surprising he is, I think he's almost hitting his ceiling already, so you're not going to bank on him to be a future starter or star by any means.
So you've got Damian Lillard, who I believe turns 27 this year, which is supposed to be quote-unquote peak power in the NBA, and you've got McCollum right behind him a year younger. How many more years of this can we put up with where they're in basically NBA purgatory, where they're not good enough to win a title but not bad enough to get a top five pick that would really help them? Are we going to see Damian Lillard's prime be wasted much the same way that Clyde Drexler's was, even though Clyde at least got two trips to the finals? Or are we going to see a championship out of this team? What do you see as their full potential?
It's really, really going to depend on what they do roster-wise in the next couple of years. And I know that that's definitely a cop-out answer, because that's the way for everybody. But the reason I say the next couple of years is because nobody has a shot at contention if you're not the Spurs, Rockets, or Warriors at West. Like, those teams are just built to continue to be powerhouses, especially the Warriors, and especially if the Warriors can somehow find a way to retain both Draymond Green and Klay Thompson. But the idea that anybody else can compete in the next two or three years, I think that's not all that realistic, unfortunately. So, just to go back to your original question, will his prime be wasted? Potentially. And it wouldn't have anything to do with what the Blazers have done or will do over the next 1 to 2 seasons. But if you get him in his age 30 season. CJ will be 29. Nurkic will be 25. You then have a very mature core that has gone through some struggles, and if you can build up the roster around them for the next 3 years, then you can start to get ready for that post Golden State Warriors dominant era.
So, gut reaction and your best bet, do you think they make the playoffs this year where they're standing right now, or do you think they miss out?
Yeah, I think they make it. I think that they figure out how to win at home, which is not something I thought I would have to say at this point, but I'm comfortable saying they'll figure out how to win at home. I think that that's going to play a big role in it. I think that the New Orleans Pelicans prove to be fool's gold. I don't think that they can sustain what they've done, and what they have done has been borderline anyway. So I think Portland gets in probably as a, I'm going to say, a seventh seed. So they probably avoid the Warriors, but they still end up with the Rockets, which is, like I already went over, almost as bad.
Right. Do you think they could beat a team like Minnesota or Oklahoma City if they made it?
Yeah, I do. I think that they have things to figure out ahead of that. They can't play as inconsistently as they are right now, but the truth is that those two teams you mentioned have also had a lot of inconsistencies this season. Minnesota, it looks like they're starting to figure out. OKC definitely has some momentum. I know that they lost their last two heading into this game against the Lakers, but they had a lot of momentum ahead of that. So, but they have had some inconsistencies, and they're still trying to figure things out with that big three, big four, if you include Steven Adams. So I think that you could definitely beat one of those teams. They're not untouchable or unbeatable at all. You just have to figure out a couple things, like how do you continue to get Jusuf Nurkić involved on the offense? Damian Lillard probably has to up his efficiency shooting the ball without giving up some of his improvements on defense. And if those things can happen, then yeah, I think you can beat anybody outside of that top four, maybe even a San Antonio Spurs if they're dealing with health and fatigue issues as well.
Well, that sounds great. I hope they can pull that off. We'll definitely watch with great interest as they go down the stretch. We're about halfway through the season now, so they've only got some time to turn it around and make good work of whatever this is. We're approaching the 45-minute mark, so we'll have to get going. But, Brian, we really appreciate coming on and your expertise, as usual, and not just sports, but all things life and culture and entertainment. And we love having you on. We appreciate you coming on. And hope you have fun on this show, because we'd love to have you on as much as we possibly can. So thank you again, sir.
Right back at you.
Well, we'll get out the door here and let you guys get on with your lives, but we appreciate you checking in. This has been Fireside Sports, presented by Oregon Sports News. I'm your host, Casey Mabbitt. He's Bryant Knox. Thank you for following us and for listening, and we'll see you next time.